Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to our Talking Markets podcast series here on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Joining me here at our 1285 podcast studio here in New York, glad to welcome back Dan Suzuki of Richard Bernstein Advisors, RBA, joining us here at the table today. So, Dan, it's great to have you here in person. Thank you for dropping by.
Yeah, thanks for having me in this exclusive opportunity to come visit you in the building for the first time, Dan.
And Dan has been on with us a few times prior, of course, serves as the Deputy Chief Investment Officer for Richard Bernstein Advisors. So very much looking forward to hearing Dan's thinking on a wide range of topics. Perhaps, Dan, beginning with the U.S. economy, that's a good place to start, accounting for the labor market, the inflationary environment. What are your expectations for the trajectory of the U.S. economy? There has been a lot of debate, discussion over a soft landing, a no landing scenario. So what's your thinking there?
Yeah, I think, you got to put into perspective of where expectations in the market narrative has been. I think that's been the thing that's swung around a lot more than actual growth. I mean, we've been sort of muddling along in this just fine economy for a while. And my expectations is that's going to last for longer than people think. And so the narrative has certainly swung. You know, we went into this year thinking there was going to be a recession. Then, you know, we're off to the races. And then just a few months ago, people were very worried again. Right around the time that the Fed had their last meeting, you know, people were saying things are really starting to crack in the economy, and that's why the Fed needs to cut 50 basis points, not just in that meeting, but from here on out. And since then, you know, you've had the narrative start to swing the other way. And I think that that's right. Now, it's very possible that that narrative continues to swing and then overshoots the upside where people get too optimistic on growth. And I think underlying all that is an economy that's pretty healthy, but an economy that's not uniform. Ever since the pandemic, I think the global economy and the U.S. economy has had a lot of stuff happening underneath the surface. We've had goods recessions and services recessions and vice versa. And even as you walk around the world, you know, certain places are very good and certain places are very bad. And so, you know, my base case here is that the U.S. economy, which is very much driven by the U.S. consumer, is probably in a gradual slowdown that eventually, you know, you have to worry about. But for the time being, it's really just a continued slowdown from these unsustainable levels post-pandemic. But on the positive side, the manufacturing goods and export side of the economy, that's basically been in a recession. That part is in recovery. That's the part that's more tied into corporate profits. And that's the part where we're optimistic because we're seeing real signs of improvement there.
So you mentioned, Dan, the commencement of the Fed's rate cutting cycle. Of course, we had the 50 basis point cut back in September. Our chief investment office calling for 100 basis points in 24, so another 25 at the November and then another 25 at the December meeting. But from RBA's lens, any expectations for the course of monetary policy through the balance of this year and even into 2025?
Yeah, you know, Dan, as I alluded to, you know, going to the last FOMC meeting, it was clear that everybody had gotten way too pessimistic on the growth outlook and then was assuming, you know, much too aggressive an outlook for Fed cuts, you know. So we actually, you know, took the opportunity to lighten up on duration, given that it has overdone. Now we've obviously seen a big resetting of expectations in the markets. I think across the long end of the curve, I think most parts of the curve are up over 50 basis points since the Fed meeting. And I think at this point, you know, they're probably more or less, fair in terms of the expectations of what's priced into the Fed. So I think the market is more or less pricing in a little less than one cut a meeting for the foreseeable future, let's call it over the next six or seven months. And I think that's probably fair. And then once you get beyond that, I don't have a tremendous amount of visibility as what the world's going to look like then. So I think, you know, right now it all seems pretty reasonable to me. But obviously, you know, the narrative is really taking hold. And I think it's possible you could see, you know, a further repricing out of Fed cuts because, you know, the reality is if you look at the situation the Fed's in, the Fed sees a world where its policies are tight. And I think that's a fair perspective. But what the Fed, I think, sometimes forgets is that they are not the only player in the liquidity game. They're more like a coxswain on a rowing team, and the rest of the rowing team is out of sync, you know, in terms of capital markets, foreign capital flows, the banks, you know, all these areas of the market have actually been providing tremendous amount of liquidity in contrast to what the Fed's been doing. And so if the Fed is going to be cutting into a world where liquidity is ample and profits are picking up steam, you know, I think we do have to start to worry about the potential risk that, you know, you do get a pickup in nominal growth. And that's something that would cause a potentially down the line a big resetting of Fed expectations at that point.
So outside of the economy, monetary policy, of course, top of mind for many investors at the moment being the upcoming U.S. election. We're recording here on Tuesday, October 22nd. So hard to believe 2 weeks away, though I'm curious, Dan, how might certain outcome scenarios, including, of course, the composition of Congress, how might that influence your macro and market outlook from here?
Yeah, you know, RBA, one of the sayings we kind of fall back on is that profits drive markets, not politics. And I think that's going to be continue to be the case. And so ultimately, we think that the political cycle and the political policies are going to be overwhelmed by whatever's happening on the global macro front and what's ultimately happening with profits. Now, there are some components of the proposed policies that may eventually impact profits. But as we've found historically, the market is just a terrible discounting mechanism for sort of pricing in and the impact of those policies. And, you know, I'm sure you've heard it time and time again, Dan. I mean, if you go back, I mean, people are still shocked that in the Biden administration, energy is basically the best performing asset, even outperforming the Magnificent Seven and Bitcoin over that time period, despite the fact that, you know, he obviously ran on more of a green platform. And then, you know, during Trump's presidency, you know, the worst performing assets among them were energy, financials, coal and steel, which were the areas that, you know, Trump, to his credit, actually put in policies, you know, to protect and deregulate. So I think for us, you know, we have to recognize that from a policy perspective, this is a rare election where both sides actually sound like they want to spend a lot of money. Usually one side wants to spend and the other side arguing for a little bit more fiscal conservatism. Both sides want to spend a lot of money. And that's going to be positive potentially for the near-term outlook for growth in an economy. But obviously in the context of where we are in inflation, that puts upward potential risk eventually to inflation. So the real difference between the two parties is, you know, where do you want to take your pain? Do you want to take it through tariffs or do you want to take it through taxes? And I think that's what the debate should come down to. But again, even if you know that such and such is going to get elected and such and such is going to happen with tax policy or tariffs, you know, I think acting on it now may not actually pay out, even if you're right in terms of the prediction.
So in consideration of the focus on profits as we're making our way through the Q3 reporting season, any takeaways from what we've seen thus far?
Yeah, I think very similar to everything else we've been talking about. It's you had extremely low expectations going into this earnings season. And the reality is that things are pretty good. And so what you're seeing is companies are beating that low bar. But more important than sort of the headline level, that overall S&P earnings growth is coming in better than expected, the thing that we've been very focused on looking for this earnings season is a continuation of the broadening out of earnings fundamentals. Over the last, you know, call it 6 or 7 quarters of this profits acceleration in the U.S., it has been, you know, somewhat narrow and dominated by the mega caps. But the difference now is that you're really starting to see it broaden out, because where we stand now, many parts of the S&P 500 or many parts of the U.S. are basically still in the profits recession. But many of these areas are exiting that profits recession and things are getting less bad. And I think that's the big opportunity that the market is just starting to wake up to over the last, call it 3 or 4 months.
So with respect to positioning within equities, I know valuations, depending on where you look, might be considered rich at the moment. Our chief investment office, per our latest house view, upgraded equities from neutral to attractive. So from a positioning standpoint within the asset class, what looks attractive to you at the moment, Dan?
Yeah, We agree. We've thought it's made sense to be overweight equities, and then within equities, obviously, we see tremendous opportunities if we're in an environment where profits growth is not only accelerating, but that profits growth is broadening out. So what we want to own here are the areas of the market that are going to be driving, you know, that broadening out of growth, that are going to be driving that acceleration in growth. And from here, you know, to us, that looks like, from a size perspective, U.S. small caps look attractive. You know, over the next couple of quarters, not only are they going to exit their profits recession, but you could, depending on how you want to measure the earnings number, you could be looking at earnings growth exiting this year that's north of 40%, which is basically going to dwarf any other growth rates. Now, you know, to be fair, those big growth rates are coming off of extremely depressed and weak numbers, but that's really where growth always comes from in the beginning anyway. Outside of the U.S. small caps, we also think the deep cyclical sectors, things like energy, industrials, materials, are also, you know, going to be seeing improving profits, profit fundamentals, you know, from very, very weak and negative growth numbers over the last, you know, three or four quarters. So I think those are the big opportunities within the U.S.
Outside of the U.S., anything look attractive at the moment? And just mindful of geopolitical concerns, no shortage of them at the moment. How do you navigate through those when considering opportunities outside of the U.S.?
Yeah, you know, for us, for better or for worse, I mean, we really try to focus on the underlying, you know, mostly profit fundamentals and the liquidity dynamic. And there, as you look at profit cycles around the world, again, you know, it's a very out of sync, you know, world. And so we've had to adjust our portfolios over the last year or two to really accommodate those different and changing profit cycles. And so, as you look out today, you know, you see Japan's profit cycle is actually slowing. Europe's profit cycle is weakening, hopefully to the point where that maybe they're getting closer to a bottom. And China's profit growth cycle, despite, you know, the recent stimulus announcements, you have to recognize that they're basically 8 or 9 quarters into their profit acceleration. So it's getting a little bit long in the tooth. And so what we've been trying to do is rotate to the areas that have a lot more runway for growth. Right now, I think that opportunity is in the non-China emerging markets. I think there's a lot to like there, because if the China stimulus story comes through, they're obviously going to be big beneficiaries of that as well. But also they have less of the geopolitical overhang. And again, you know, they're only, call it, 2 or 3 quarters into their profits recovery. So there's more room for recovery there. Not to mention, to the extent that we do see sort of a pickup in inflationary concerns, you know, that's going to flow through the commodity side and benefit the earnings of some of these areas.
Well, Dan, we've covered a lot of ground in a short period of time, and thank you again for joining us. Before we close out, any final thoughts, takeaways, or anything you would like to reinforce to our audience?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, there's always sort of this push-pull, tug-of-war dynamic between the short-term opportunities and the long-term opportunities. I think right now, as we sit here today, there's an opportunity to take advantage of both. As I look out over the very long term, I think there's tremendous opportunities in the areas that people don't want to own, and some long-term secular trends, things like deglobalization, you know, potentially higher inflation, you know, what's going to happen with the government, you know, balance sheet and dynamic. I think when you put all those together, you know, you want to have real asset exposure in the portfolio. You want to have things that benefit from higher inflation, even if it's going to be cyclical over that time period. And where we sit today, you know, because we're in a profit cycle upturn, because we're in a tight economy, you know, there's also potential for those things to do well in the near term. So again, the deep cyclical areas, whether that be energy, industrials, materials, or U.S. small caps, contrary to popular belief, can do well in a period of accelerating nominal growth. I think those are some great opportunities to own here today, but also could be some of the best performing investments over the next 10 years.
Well, Dan, thank you for dropping by. It was great catching up, and do appreciate the transparency around positioning guidance and for sharing your thinking with our listeners when it comes to the macro and market environment. So looking forward to having you back again at some point, Dan. Thank you again.
Thanks, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreement and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.